Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service to the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on America, B.C., when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and the paper money and clad coin that we have in circulation today. And you know, that's very true when you're dealing with banks or with government or industry. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper over gold coin. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, you know, neither did our Congress and our politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate us, a free people, that they must first take away our gold and silver coin to take away our rights to property and to destroy our property rights under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the holy grail. It's the legal foundation for all of our liberties in our legal system. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order a free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about America, B.C., written by Barry Fell. Let me give you the vital statistics here on the book. It's fairly simple. The title is America, B.C., Ancient Settlers in the New World. Just look for America, B.C. by Barry Fell. His name is spelled F-E-L-L. Now, if you go down to any used bookstore and you say, I want America, B.C. by Barry Fell, they'll plug that into the computer and they'll find you a copy. Now, I've got a paperback issue here, and I don't think it's more than $15. I think you can get it probably at Barnes & Noble. Just walk in the door, say, hey, listen, America, B.C., Barry Fell. It will open your eyeballs to the lies, the hypocrisy, and the deception that's going on in our educational institutions today and expose for you in broad daylight the lying chicanery that's been going on from the time you were in the first grade. I was watching the Lehrer News Hour last night, and had a segment on there concerning our public schools. And they said, our public schools are failing us. And in the segment, they said, we've got to spend more money, and we've got to lower our class size. And the reading and the math, the test scores are below the national average, and it's just really bad. And we're talking about the District of Columbia schools, you know, the inner city schools. And I looked at that and I said, you know, where have I heard that story before? Now think about this. Just think now. All of your life, test scores have been going down, and the solution to Johnny can't read is more money and lower class size. Isn't it? Is there any other solution? Lower class size, more money. And everybody said, kind of chomping at the bits, and went, oh, God, what are we going to do? Now, let me tell you a story. I went to the public school system back in the 1940s. Johnny could read, Johnny could write, and Johnny could add and subtract. We didn't have any problems. And when we got through at the end of the day, say third grade, Mrs. Wilds, when we got through at the end of the day, at the end of the class year, every child, 32 of them in that class, this lady was about 62 when I was in the third grade. She was 62 years old. Jenny Wilds was her name, an old lady. And she ruled the class with an iron hand. That was number one. There was discipline in the class, and that was yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Number one. She divided the class into three groups, of smart, ordinary, and dumb. And she taught to the highest common denominator, the smartest kids in the class. And everybody was trying to emulate. Everybody was trying to get to the top of the class. Today, we teach to the bottom of the class. We hold everybody that's smart back to the least common denominator, which is the dumbest kid. Now, we practice the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. The 10th plank calls for free education for all children in public schools. When I went to public school, it was a bad educational system. And it has gotten worse from 1947 to 2007. And from 2007 to 2047, it will get even worse. It will never get better. It will only get worse. It will only degenerate. So if you want your children to go to public school, have at it. You're in the majority. But don't wring your hands and wonder why Johnny can't read, can't write, and can't spell. Communism has never worked anywhere in the world where it has been tried. We Americans are now implementing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. They tried it in China, it didn't work. They tried it in Russia, and it didn't work. They abandoned it and went to the free market system and got onto something a little better. It's working. We Americans will go the way of the communists that have preceded us. We will totally fail and be taken into national captivity. That's the bottom line. Now, then I've given you the bad news. The purpose behind that is the reason that we don't know about America BC is because we went to public school and we were lied to, pure and simple. And that's one of the tenets of communism. You lie to people for the purposes of people control. But communism isn't anything new. Whether it's Catholicism or communism or capitalism or fascism or socialism, you know, just hang an ism out there, and it's got a least common denominator, and that is people control. That's the bottom line. It always has been. For thousands of years past, it is now and always will be thousands of years into the future if time goes on with man in control. Now, fortunately, there's a God out there in heaven someplace, and he said, I'm going to come back and straighten that mess out. And when I do, there's going to be weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, you know, for us down here on planet Earth, God isn't here yet. We still have this people control mentality, and we're practicing communism here in the United States, Canada, and Australia, Western Europe. And we think that we're really smart and up-to-date and chic and just right on top of everything. Until we pick up America BC and find out, hey, we're not nearly as knowledgeable, not nearly as smart as we thought we were. Now, when we broke off last time, I was telling you that there was an Egyptian presence here in the New World. And the Egyptian presence was very plain up in Maine with a group of people called the Mi'kmaq Indians. And we discovered, and this has been around since 1866, a document up there that a fellow who was a missionary up to the Mi'kmaqs had translated from the English into the Mi'kmaq language. And come to find out, the Mi'kmaqs are using Egyptian hieroglyphics. Egyptian hieroglyphics. Now, where in the hell did the Mi'kmaq Indians learn about Egyptian hieroglyphics? Did the Mi'kmaqs go to Egypt? Did the Egyptians come to Maine? You know, something happened there, didn't it? You know, if you haven't been to college and you haven't had your mind totally shut off, something happened, didn't it? Going on. He says, now, I had read in standard works on the American Indians that certain tribes in the Northeast make use of the hieroglyphic writing system invented by missionary priests who found it easier to teach the Indians by using hieroglyphic signs. But that did not accord with the evidence now before me, because this seemed to show that somehow someone familiar with Egyptian hieroglyphics had contrived the Mi'kmaq writing. Now, he's got a couple of pages here of the signs and the examples of the Mi'kmaq and the Egyptian, and they're identical. So he takes the Mi'kmaq sign over here for reader graph, and then the ancient Egyptian sign for reader graph. And then here's the sign for it to keep safe and to preserve, greetings, hi. And then here's the opposite sign over here, and they're either similar, some of them are exact, and some of them are very close. The Mi'kmaq are a tribe of Algonquin Indians inhabiting Acadia, the eastern provinces of Canada, and they're closely related to various tribes of Maine, commonly called the Wabanaki or the Men of the East. Reference to Schoolcraft's great work on the American Indian showed that he reported to Congress in 1851 that reading and writing are altogether unknown to them, that is, to the Algonquin Indians. This statement, combined with a recorded claim by an 18th century French priest, Pierre Millard, that he personally invented the Mi'kmaq hieroglyphics, seemed to establish the reputed modernity of the writing system. Had Millard then studied Egyptian hieroglyphics in order to invent his Mi'kmaq system? Well, a check on the dates soon showed that this would be impossible, because Millard died in 1762, 61 years before Champollion published his first decipherment of the Egyptian hieroglyphics. Any resemblance between his system and that of the Egyptians would have to be due to pure chance. So I asked John to look for more examples of Mi'kmaq writing, if these could be located in the Widener Library or elsewhere. He soon came upon a copy of a 450-page book of Mi'kmaq hieroglyphics. It was the work of Father Millard, containing much of the Catholic Order of the Mass, a catechism, a religious history, and translations of the Psalms and hymns. This was printed in Vienna during the years 1863 to 1866 from original manuscripts bequeathed by Father Millard to the Mi'kmaq Indians at the time of his death in 1762. Well, it proved to contain hundreds of different hieroglyphic signs, of considerable proportion of which are clearly derived from or even identical with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics or their hieratic equivalents. Examples of the writing and its Egyptian counterpart are shown in the tables accompanying this chapter. And as was now quite obvious, the Mi'kmaq writing system, and also part of their language, is derived from ancient Egyptian. But how could this be? Surely Millard could not have secretly deciphered the Egyptian language himself. Besides, he's not known ever to have traveled to Egypt or to have been involved in any activity beyond that of the devoted care of his Indian flock, who lovingly preserved his manuscripts for 120 years. So we now had the makings of another first-class mystery. At John's earnest request on my behalf, the librarians at Harvard began to make available to us all of the relevant books on the Mi'kmaq and the Wabanaki Indians, and from some of these, listed in the bibliography at the end of this book, I now learned the truth of the matter. It turns out, on the evidence of Father Millard's contemporaries and successors, that he did not really invent the writing system, but instead he borrowed and adapted a system of writing already in use among the Indians at the time when Cardinal Richelieu first dispatched French missionaries to work among the Canadian Indians. From various depositories, nor depictions made by authorities listed in the bibliography in section 9, page 304, it is clear that when the first Christian instruction was given to the Mi'kmaqs, the French priests noticed that some children appeared to be making signs on birch bark while the priests were preaching. When questioned later, the children explained that they were recording some of the statements. They explained that a five-pointed star represents heaven and a circle represents the earth and so forth. Father Eugene Vitromilli, in 1866, relates the same of the Wabanaki, among whom he worked in Maine, and his account, the most illuminating, may be taken as applying evidently to the Mi'kmaqs. It is as follows, and his statements are supported by other missionaries, notably by the Right Reverend Bishop Colin F. McKinnon, the Bishop of Arakat, and a leading authority on the Mi'kmaq Indians. When the French first arrived in Acadia, the Indians used to write on bark from trees and stones and engraving signs and arrows, sharp stones, or other instruments. They were accustomed to send pieces of bark marked with these signs to other Indians of other tribes and to receive back answers written in the same manner, just as we do with letters and notes today. Their chiefs used to send circulars made in the same manner to all of their men in time of war to ask their advice and to give directions. From this evidence, it is clear that we have for long been mistaken in thinking of the Mi'kmaq writing system as a modern invention, and hence unworthy of serious study by any epigrapher or epigrapher interested in the history of writing systems in ancient times. Father Vitromilli goes on to say that he has in his personal possession three manuscripts in the Mi'kmaq hieroglyphic style. This was, of course, in 1866, and so far I have been unable to trace the present whereabouts of his original manuscripts, two of which, he says, were written by Indians. Vitromilli also states that several Indians possessed in the time of the first French missions, in their wigwams, a kind of library composed of stones and of pieces of bark, and the medicine men had large manuscripts of these peculiar characters, which they read over the sick person. The Indians assert that by these signs they could express any idea with every modification, just as we do with our writing today. And when the French missionaries arrived in this country, they made use of these signs as they found them in order to instruct the Indians. Fathers Minard, or Millard, is doubtless intended, and the Lalutre improved them. And others were added in order to express the doctrine and mysteries of the Christian religion. Unquote. Now, Father Vitromilli records that similar writing was employed by all of the northern Algonquin tribes, the Mi'kmaqs, the Wabanakis, and the Etchemis in northern New England included. And he says that he has met older people among the Indians at Old Town, Maine, who remember a time when the writing was inscribed vertically and also horizontally as today, but in either direction, he has. Now let me just pause here for a moment and make a comment. Could it be that modern archaeologists today simply haven't heard of this? And that's why they haven't reported on it? Or is it that they knew or know and refused to report on it to keep it hidden? Now, which is it? In the Bible, there's a statement that the Apostle Paul made. He said, speaking of the pagans around him, he said, "For this they are willingly ignorant." Willingly ignorant. Kent Hovind translated that, and he said, that means dumb on purpose. Dumb on purpose. I liked his translation. Why is it that we are dumb on purpose? Because there's a political and there's a social motivation behind all of this. Because, boys and girls, think about it pragmatically. We've been taught that we are evolving, that there is no God. We are evolving, and we're getting smarter and smarter as time progresses. The evidence herein shows plainly that we are not evolving, we are devolving, we are getting dumber and dumber, as evidenced by our educational system today. Boys and girls, in 1900, the average vocabulary of a high school graduate, now granted, most people in 1900 did not graduate from high school. However, point this out. The average high school graduate in 1900 in the United States of America had a vocabulary of 20,000 words. 20,000. Today, in 2007, the average American high school graduate has a vocabulary of 10,000, one half the vocabulary. And are you telling me that we're evolving smarter and smarter and getting better and better? No, boys and girls, we're devolving and we're getting dumber and dumber. Test scores are getting poorer and poorer, not higher and higher. Every report that you see on television tells you plainly that your reading, writing, and math test scores are lower and lower and lower every year. That's not evolution. That's getting dumber and dumber. You're not getting smarter and smarter. Now, there was a time when we were smarter than we are today. Well, then, if we were smarter in 1900 than we are today, could it be that we were smarter 3,000 years ago than we are today? Now, you know, right away you're going to say, oh, no, no, that can't be. Well, hang on a second. Hang on a second. When was the last time a pyramid like the Great Pyramid has been constructed here in the United States? Well, boys and girls, we got 8 or 9 of them here in the United States. And the last time that those were built was back in antiquity, thousands of years ago. Now you're going to sit there and say, well, we haven't got any reason to build one. Boys and girls, if we had a reason to build one, we couldn't, because we don't have the technology for it. Now somebody's going to write me a letter and say, oh, no, no, Mr. Gordon, we can build those today. Excuse me. You can fly to the moon. You can fly jet airplanes. I don't deny it, but you can't build another pyramid. Well, we don't have any reason to build a pyramid. Don't have any reason to fly to the moon either, but you do it. You do it because of the military technology behind it. You're not out there flying in outer space for no good reason. You're out there developing weapons of mass destruction. That's the purpose behind it. Now, if there was a purpose behind building a great pyramid, if we could build a great pyramid which would kill more people faster and more efficiently, you can rest assured we'd be out there building pyramids today. But we're not, and we can't, and we don't, and we won't. But somebody in the past built them, and I suspect they had a reason. Now, we're being constantly bombarded with this concept. Well, it was religious. These people were all superstitious. They're all a bunch of dummies. Bunch of dummies? Stonehenge was built by a bunch of dummies. These people put 30-ton rocks 15 feet into the air, and they're a bunch of dummies? Those rocks were mined, and or they were quarried, and they were transported 400 miles, and these people were dummies? Huh? Hey, listen, Smarty, why don't you go out, quarry a 30-ton rock, move it 400 miles, lift it 15 feet in the air? Why don't you demonstrate that for me, Smarty? And you're telling me these people were dumb? Now we're finding out that Stonehenge, for instance, was an advanced astronomical observatory which depicted in its construction the phases of the sun and the moon and the stars. And these people were what? Excuse me. Take a high school graduate today. Take a college graduate today and ask him some simple questions like Jay Leno does on The Tonight Show and see how smart these people are coming out of our educational institutions today. Huh? Jay Leno, from time to time on The Tonight Show, will go out on the street and he'll interview college students, people that have graduated from high school and are now in college, young people, you know, 20 years old. And he'll ask them questions concerning history or current events or something like that that's in the news, typically history or math questions or something. And the answers that he gets out of these adults is absolutely mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. For an old man listening to that diatribe coming out of the mouths of these fools, it makes me sick. It makes me want to puke. And they call that education? No, communism has never produced education. They have produced robots. Communism produces a mass stereotype of followers, not educated people that think for themselves and that can create and produce. Now, here in America, we used to have people that could create and produce. Henry Ford was one of them, but you don't find many of them today. This fellow Bill Gates is one of them. There are a few, no doubt, there are a few. And almost inevitably, when you find them, they got out of school before their brains were totally burned out on either drugs or the educational process. Public school never worked for the communists. and I doubt if it's going to work any better for the Americans, Canadians, or Australians. Now, give it a try. Keep after it. Meanwhile, back on the farm, some of us out here would like to actually know what in the hell was the truth, what actually happened here. And now we find out from America BC that we've been lied to by our academic institutions, and it's done for mind control, because the opposite to evolution is special creation. And if we were created by a divine being, I'm going to presume that he was a little smarter than the creation that he made. My common sense says that the man who creates the computer is smarter than the computer. The God that created the man is probably a little smarter than the man that he created. Now, the man that he created was pretty smart in ancient times because he could build pyramids with expansion joints to plus or minus a half an inch. That's pretty technologically advanced. He could mine or make stone of irregular shapes of gigantic weights like 50 tons and then make other stones of irregular shapes match with them to within plus or minus 50 thousandths of an inch, which, you know, in machine terminology isn't very close, but for stonework it's real close. Real close. And we can't duplicate that technology today. We cannot make those kinds of rock cuts with that kind of precision and accuracy. Now, boys and girls, whoever was doing that, building Stonehenge, building these monuments, building these pyramids, were not sewing goat guts together to make them. If you had to have a laser transit to measure the damn thing, you had to have at least a laser transit to build it. Where on earth are our minds, kids? You know, if we were going to fly to the moon, and we were going to say, well, we designed this space rocket, and we were using goat guts to level up the launch pad over here, you'd think that somebody that made such a statement was insane, wouldn't you? And rightly so. Nobody's flying rockets to the moon by leveling up the launch pad by sewing goat guts together. And nobody built the Great Pyramid sewing goat guts. You know, I say it's time to take a look at these educators over here that have been lying to us for all these years and start educating ourselves. You're not going to educate yourself in public school. That's the place where you got dumbed down to start with. That was the problem. Now, I went to school in the 1940s. I wasn't dumbed up. I was dumbed down. I wasn't when I got out of the program, the institution. I was institutionalized for 12 years. After my institutionalization, I wasn't smarter than the previous generation. I was dumber than my father, who was dumber than his father, who was dumber than his father. We've been in a process of dumbing down, not building up. That's the bottom line. Hey, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements are recommendations that we give. Do not mean that those authors or publications so endorsed are necessarily going to, or that we recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And the reason for that is that these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour sometimes are hostile, or they may be political or religious, or they may be economic or sectarian, racial or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Up and down the Arkansas River, there are numerous sites. Probably, I'm just going to throw a number out here, 25 sites. Now, there's more than that. but I'm going to tell you there's 25, where you'll find this Ogham writing. Now, Ogham is a system of writing similar to hieroglyphics. It's a system whereby there's a code, and you can chisel this into the rock. Now, these ancient people actually chiseled into the rock their written instructions, called Hebrew or Irish or Gaelic Ogham, O-G-A-M, Ogham. And they just use six lines, but these six lines are organized in such a way you can have that slant in two directions. You have a medium line, and then you can be above the line or below the line, or you can be exactly in the middle of the line. And this fellow, Barry Fell and Gloria Farley, going up and down the Arkansas River, would identify this Ogham writing, and they could translate it because they can read the Irish writing in Ireland. So they came over here and they took a look at this Ogham over here, and it's identical to the Irish writing. So that tells you that the people in Ireland were over here in the New World. Question arises, well, when were they here? And then what happened to them? And where did they go? When we take a look at the Eastern Indians here in the United States, they're different from the Western Indians. Very different. In fact, many of them were called the civilized tribes. And they had a form of government. And they had written language. Not all of them, but many of them did. And in these civilized tribes, like the Cherokees, for instance, they had a written language. And these people had government. These people were cut off over here from the old world. And so when Columbus got over here, called them Indians. Now, they were no more Indians than you and I are. Even the Native Americans over here chafe a little bit under this common name or common concept of Indian. If you'll remember the story, Columbus was trying to get to India. His motivation was money. He didn't have anything to do with exploration. They were trying to find a route directly to India. They knew how to get to India. They would take off out of Spain and Portugal and sail south down along the African coast. Then they'd round the Cape of Good Hope down South Africa, come up the east side of Africa, and then sail across the Indian Ocean to India, pick up a load of spices, and then they would sail south down the eastern side of Africa and around the Cape of Good Hope and all the way back up and come across to Portugal and Spain again. Why did they do that? Well, because their trade route was interdicted by the Arabs, the Muslim Arabs. And they had to pay the Arabs to bring those spices in from Indian silks from China and so on. They wanted to do business with the Orient, with the Indians. And the Arabs were there taking a cut off of it. So Columbus, a businessman, and his business associates said, you know, if we could sail directly to the west, we think that we would reach India. So he said, yeah, we think that's true. They had no idea how big the world was. They didn't know if it was 12,000 miles or 30,000 miles or 300,000 miles, but they were pretty confident that by sailing west that they could reach the east. Now, of course, the Catholic Church is teaching at this time the world's flat. Got that? This is the Catholic Church now. These are the erudite, educated monks in the monasteries with all the writing and all the rest. Now, whether they believed it or whether they were just teaching it, I don't know. George Bush tells us a lot of things that we ought to, you know, question, and I'm pretty sure that he knows better. I mean, he might believe his own propaganda, but I think he actually knows the truth. And I suspect that these Catholic priests, they probably knew the truth also. But Columbus did us a great service. But when he got to the New World, he called these people Indians. Indians. And so the name stuck. And so the American Indians, the Native Americans, have been over here all these years. Some of them are white. Some of these Indians over here, boys and girls, are white. And when you dig up the burial mounds, you find that anthropologically, you know, when you take a look at an Oriental guy, you dig up the bones over here in China. And then you compare those bones with some guy you dig up over in Europe. You know, you can look at the bones and you can say, well, now this is a different race. Different races have different bone structure. Very common. We've known that for a long time. Now, you come over here to the Americas and you find, when you dig around in these burial mounds, and this is where Fell and Gloria Farley discovered all over the Midwest, there are burial mounds. And during the Depression years, people would go into those burial mounds and dig them out, and they would find artifacts, and oftentimes they would find gold and silver coin. They would find wealth in there. So during the Depression years, they desecrated hundreds, if not thousands, of these burial mounds all over the Midwest. Why wasn't that reported? Why wasn't that interdicted by the archaeologists of the time? Today, when you go out here in let's just pick a place, you know, like New Mexico, and you buy a pot from somebody, if they find out that that's an Indian pot, they'll arrest and jail you. Do you know that? Now, these archaeologists, in perpetrating this hoax upon us that we have evolved and we came across a land bridge into the New World, are jealously guarding the lies and the propaganda that they have put out. And today they've had laws enacted by Congress to protect these sites. And I'm not sitting here saying to you that they ought not to. But they're not trying to protect a single one of these sites, like the 25 I just mentioned to you. There's more than that, but at least 25 of these ancient peoples over here. In fact, the Vandals have gotten to many of those sites and destroyed much of what was there. So the archaeologist of today, if he wants to protect the Indian culture and his philosophies and his beliefs, he goes to Congress and he gets laws passed. These laws do not apply to these ancient sites. And they've been vandalized, they've been destroyed. In fact, Gloria Farley said that she knows of many sites that she has never identified the exact location of. She's photographed it and documented it, never located the sites, for fear that when they do, they will go out, and this is probably at the instigation of the current crop of archaeologists themselves, that they would go out and destroy what's there, because it's counter to their teaching and their philosophies. Boys and girls, that's not science. That's superstition. That's philosophy. That's politics. But it doesn't have anything to do with reason, logic, or common sense. It doesn't even reach common sense, much less science. I had an opportunity to view a television interview between Barry Fell and two other of his associates and some archaeologists. This was done in Denver, Colorado, over one of their TV stations. The archaeologists, who were the modern college variety, were just spewing venom as they ridiculed and impugned Barry Fell and his associates here of the Epigraphic Society. And Fell at the time, this is back in the 70s, he wasn't running around saying, you know, I've got the truth and the rest of you fools are all a bunch of bumpkins over here. He was rather presenting evidence and saying, don't you think that we ought to investigate this? Don't you think that this means something? Because look at this ogham. This ogham can be translated from Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, from the ogham that we have over here in Ireland. And because we can translate it, we can see that these people were the same, that these Irishmen, these Celtic people were here in the New World before the Indians. Don't you think we should investigate that? And the other side over here, there's a couple, three of those guys, they just spewed venom. This is nonsense. This is propaganda. This is blah, 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 blah. You know, there's a layperson sitting over there, said, well, it sounds pretty interesting to me. Why don't we look at it? Give this guy an opportunity to present his case. Let's listen to it and be fair with an open mind and see what he's got to say. So if you're sitting there in radio land and you're saying, my God, this sounds too preposterous to be true. It sounds kind of like it's Mormonish. I know. I first heard years and years ago, this Mormon guy said, yeah, we believe that Jesus came over here to the New World B.C. Well, not B.C., but, you know, during his lifetime. And I'm sitting over here saying, well, that sounds kind of religion-y to me. Could it be true? I don't know. Is there any evidence? Well, if somebody comes along and says, well, I've got some evidence of that, you know, as a trained professional myself, I would say, well, let's listen to what the guy's got to say. That's what we do in the judicial process. We come into court and we say, okay, sit down, shut up. Let this guy make his presentation. Let him examine his witnesses. Let's listen with an open mind. Let's take notes. Let's see if this guy contradicts himself. Let's cross-examine him. Let's examine him. Let's ask him hard questions. And if he can answer the questions and survive cross-examination, then maybe he's got something worth listening to. And boys and girls, what I've been observing here is that the academic community won't even give these people a fair shake. They won't even give them a hearing. You can't even make your presentation. And then they enact laws over here to protect the archaeological digs that they use to prove that man evolved from green algae, and then the archaeological sites that would tend to prove or show or cast light upon special creation, they ridicule, they impugn, and destroy. Now, much has been destroyed, but there is so much here, you can't destroy it all. That's the bottom line. They have uncovered more than 3,000 sites. 3,000 sites all over America and Canada. They're everywhere. Has that ever been reported to you? Boys and girls, when you got 3,000 sites with ogham writing, Egyptian hieroglyphics, Roman coins, Roman pots, here in the New World, you know, 3,000 of those start to add up. It isn't like we found one, two, or three, and it's an enigma, and it's not nearly enough to prove the case. Has anybody ever told you that there were more than 3,000 of these sites? Of which I said there's 25 up and down the Arkansas River that is just the tip of the iceberg. There's many more than that. But when you find 25 sites in several states, and you've got Hebrew or Celtic ogham writing that you can translate from Ireland, and then this goes back and you start asking the Indians that are there, say, did you put this up here? No, we didn't know where that came from. When you go to these Mi'kmaq Indians and you find that they're using Egyptian hieroglyphics, you know, you got to ask the question, where'd you learn that? When you see a pyramid down here in Mexico City that looks just like the pyramids of Egypt, you got to ask, well, where did you get the idea for that construction? What, did you see a picture? Did somebody, you know, I could build one of those pyramids now because I've seen some pictures of them, but, you know, before I'd ever seen a picture of a pyramid, how would I know how to build a pyramid? And these pyramids over here, by the way, in Illinois, are constructed in the pyramid shape, but they're built out of earth, just dirt. why did they use a pyramid shape? Why didn't they use a rectangle or a square or a circle or something else? You know, why a pyramid? All right, now we're reviewing the book called America BC, written by Barry Felt. If you didn't get the name and number down here, let me review it again. It's America BC, simple title. And then it was published by Pocket Books, a division of Simon & Schuster, 1230 Avenue of the Americas, New York, New York, 10020. Again, that's 1230 Avenue of the Americas is the street. New York, New York, 10020, Simon & Schuster, copyrighted 1976 and then reissued in 1989. And the author is Barry Fell, B-E-R-R-Y-F-E-L-L. I think it's still in print. I imagine you could get a copy at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, or go to your local used bookstore and simply ask for a copy, see if they can find one. There's a chapter in here called Mystery Hill. It's chapter 7. In which he says, by the beginning of May of 1975, several signs began to warn us that there was a faint but real possibility that we might be on the verge of solving the most baffling problem of American archaeology, namely, the identity of the boulders of the mysterious root cellars of the northeastern states and the date of their occupation. And here were the signs. First, the so-called root cellars appeared to be the work of megalithic people. That is, they resembled corresponding structures in Europe dating from the Bronze Age and known to have been in use by the Celts in classical times. That was the first thing that tipped them off. Secondly, we now knew that Celtic inscriptions occur in Spain and Portugal, associated with Iberian Punic inscriptions and in the vicinity of megalithic structures. That was the second thing that tipped them off. Third, Iberian Punic inscriptions were identified by me at sites near Boston, to which I was taken by James Whittall, and these inscriptions appeared to be the work of casual voyagers visiting America during the era of about 500 to 300 BC. And although my researches up to this time had been related to inscriptions of Europe and the Far East, Jim Whittall perceived that the parallels between the archaeological settings in New England and in Western Europe are now much clearer than had previously been realized. He now began to show me the files of photographs taken by Malcolm Pearson over the previous 35 years, illustrating the principal features of the so-called root cellars and other apparently megalithic structures. In company with Professor Norman Totten, chairman of the Department of History at Bentley College, we studied these and we pored over every detail that we could make out, searching for traces of ogham or other lettering that might disclose if any Celtic occupation had occurred. None could be detected. Reluctantly, I had to tell Jim that unless there were inscriptions, I could throw no light on this problem. Nonetheless, despite these discouraging results in the beginning, Jim Whittall and I visited the best known of the sites on June 14th. This site is known as Mystery Hill, New Hampshire. It is a complex of stone slab chambers, and they are associated hinge stones, oriented so that the sun sets behind particular standing stones on the days of the equinox and the summer and winter solstices. The site covers 60 acres, mostly occupied by second-growth woodland, through which run peculiar constructed dry stone walls with tall pointed triangular stones occurring at regular intervals in the walls. It includes an area of about 1 acre covered by a maze of massive stone chambers with various other striking but puzzling features such as the so-called Table of Sacrifice. Now, there are pictures of all of these sites here in the book, photographs. I never saw these photographs. I went to the public school system. I never saw pictures of these kinds of sites here in the United States. Nobody ever said to me, now listen, we got some strange archaeological sites here in America. We don't know what they mean. We can't read or decipher them. But here they are. They're in New Hampshire. They're in Vermont, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, Quebec. They're in Minnesota. They're all over the place. More than 3,000 of them. We can't read them. We don't know what they mean. But now, why destroy them? Now, I can understand, you know, people in desperation in the 1930s going into these burial mounds and tearing them apart and desecrating them and taking out the things that were buried there and selling them to buy beans and cornbread to feed their families. Now, that makes all the sense in the world. Grave robbing has been going on for millennia, forever. Then it makes sense. There's something of value there. Let's dig it up. But you know, these people that call themselves archaeologists, they call themselves scientists. And they depict themselves as being the curators, the preservers, the people who are trying to uncover the truth of mankind's past. That's the way they come to us. It reminds me of the ancient Romans that we call the bedrock of civilization. The Romans were not the bedrock of civilizations. They were the destroyers of civilizations. The Romans, when they got to Alexandria, destroyed the library. When they got to Carthage, they destroyed all of the written records of the Carthaginians. They were destroyers. Here in America, we are witnessing today in 2007, and have been over the last 50 years, the destruction of history, the destruction of knowledge. These people are not advancing knowledge one whit. They're advancing lies and propaganda. They are advancing superstition and fairy tales, not truth, not science, and not knowledge. Now, fortunately, there were some things that they didn't destroy out of Carthage. There were some artifacts that didn't get destroyed, like the Rosetta Stone. It wasn't that they didn't try. It wasn't that they wouldn't have destroyed it had they known about it. But you know, there's just so much of it, kids. They can't destroy it all. They can't stamp it all out. And so there's always a little bit of truth that keeps getting through. It's like the story of the ancient Israelites, you know. They're called in the Bible the lost sheep of the house of Israel, the lost tribes of Israel. Well, they've been found. Not because any archaeologist went out and diligently searched for them, because they were busily trying to hide the evidence, trying to destroy the knowledge. But some of it has seeped through. And this is the book, and we'll take it up right here next time at Mystery Hill. There's actually some truth out there, and it's available in the book called America BC by Barry Fell, which we'll take up next time here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But we're about out of time, kids, and I got to give you a final reminder that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course, until then. Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.